War between Israel and Lebanon has reached new heights. A party founded by two former SS officers have won elections in Austria, and Russia has finally taken a town they've been fighting for years. We have all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Welcome back to Trumpet World. We're doing things a little bit different today. We might get into God's Holy Day calendar in a future show, but the Feast of Trumpets disrupted our recording schedule this week. But with so much news, we still wanted to bring you an update. So I'm recording this on the road after making a trip to France to visit some of our brethren there. Others are sending in their recordings or recording in their own studio, but in their own time, as we try and fit this around the Holy Days. And with so much dramatic news from the Middle East, we'll start with an update from Mihailo Zekic.
On Friday evening, right before the start of the Sabbath around the Holy Land, the Israeli Air Force carried out an airstrike in Beirut. But this was not just an ordinary attack between Israel and the Lebanese terror group Hezbollah. This took out Hezbollah's leader, Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah. He has been leading Hezbollah since 1992 and is one of the most, if arguably not the most, powerful terrorists in the Middle East up until his death. Under him, Hezbollah has been responsible for the deaths of thousands worldwide, aside from his not too infrequent wars with Israel. He's also carried out terror attacks against Jews all around the world, including places as seemingly remote as Argentina, Bulgaria. There was recently news of a Hezbollah cell in Germany exposed. He also led Hezbollah into the Syrian civil war, supporting Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in besieging his own cities and killing Syrian civilians. He was a very, very dangerous guy, and he was one of Israel's biggest personal enemies. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, for his part, was actually in New York giving a speech to the United Nations. And according to certain reports, this was actually used as a decoy to lull Nasrallah into a false sense of security. And it was actually while Nasrallah and some of his men were watching Netanyahu's speech on the television, it was believed that the strike happened.
I have a message for the tyrants of Tehran. If you strike us, we will strike you. There is no place in Iran that the long arm of Israel cannot reach. And that's true of the entire Middle East.
That was an excerpt from Netanyahu's speech. And you could very well say he was making that threat to Nasrallah himself, perhaps as Nasrallah was watching that very segment. Now, as Hezbollah is one of Iran's biggest proxies in the Middle East, certainly one of the most well-funded, well-armed, assassinating Hezbollah's leader after so many of the leaders in the organization, whether political or commanding military forces, have already been assassinated by Israel. This did not sit well with Iran, and a lot of people were nervous about what direction the next phase of the war would take. Well, on Monday, the Israeli Defense Forces partook in intelligence gathering small-scale raids across the Lebanese border, and the next day, Israel had officially commenced its ground invasion of Lebanon, ostensibly to remove the threat of Hezbollah and that opposes to northern Israel once and for all. An estimated 60,000 Israelis have been forced to evacuate their homes for months because of Hezbollah's near-constant bombardment of northern Israel's communities since last October. How far Israel will go remains to be seen. According to the IDF, they intend this invasion to be limited, localized, and targeted.
If the state of Lebanon and the world can't push Hezbollah away from our border. We have no choice but to do it ourselves. I want to make it clear. Our war is with Hezbollah, not with the people of Lebanon. We do not want to harm Lebanese civilians, and we're taking measures to prevent that. We will not let 7th of October happen again on any one of our borders. We will continue doing whatever necessary so that Israeli families can return to their homes in safety and security.
That was IDF spokesman Daniel Hagari announcing some of the plans that they were intending for this Lebanese invasion. But even if these are to be targeted raids, as you could hear from Hagari, Hezbollah still poses a threat to Israel, even if so many of its capabilities have been neutralized, have been made null. Hezbollah still has access to thousands of projectiles, such as precision-guided missiles. There still are tens of thousands of soldiers within Hezbollah's ranks. Israel is not necessarily in the clear yet, and as of Tuesday night, Iran, for its part, launched its retaliation for Nasrallah's death in the form of almost 200 precision-guided missiles crossing the Middle East. Most of them were apparently taken down by Israel's missile defense systems. Some of them escaped these systems, and in at least one case, a Palestinian in the West Bank was killed from debris falling from a missile that was flying over. So where this increasingly escalatory war will take Israel, will take Hezbollah, will take Iran, remains to be seen. But there are a few interesting facets with this war that merit closer inspection. The fact that Israel was able to assassinate Nasrallah and for a few days at least not receive any significant retaliation from Hezbollah, you combine that with the infamous pager attack that Israel did, how it's already assassinated so many of Hezbollah's leaders. And while Hezbollah still has a lot of military capability, they certainly seem like they are on the back pedal in this war. And for Iran's part, originally they said that they were not going to launch their retaliation themselves, but expect Hezbollah and the other proxy groups to do so. Now, the missile attack was a bit of a face-saving measure, but even that was at least numerically smaller than the barrage that Iran gave Israel in April when it was avenging the death of an Iranian general who was much less of an important person to Iran than Nasrallah was. And Ayatollah Khamenei, the Iranian supreme leader, for his part, after the news broke out of Nasrallah's death, went into a safe house, apparently signaling that even Iran doesn't itself and its security apparatus doesn't know if the Mossad and Israel's other intelligence agencies are able to assassinate the Ayatollah on his own soil. And it looks like the writing may be on the wall for Hezbollah. Again, it's too early to tell. Things could dramatically change by the time this episode airs. But that is the general direction that things appear to be going in. And this is interesting for the trumpet for a number of reasons, but the main one being a prophecy in Psalm 83, which discusses a group of nations in the Middle East coming together to form an alliance that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. That is in verse 4. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Giro Fleury, has previously commented that this alliance of those particular peoples in that alliance has never formed either in biblical history or in secular history, which is why we look at it as a prophecy. And specifically, among a lot of other different groups that you could trace as the ancestral peoples of Jordan, of the Gulf Arab states, of Syria, of Turkey, verses 7 mention Gebal and Tyre, which are two cities that are located in Lebanon today. And we expect Lebanon to be a part of this alliance. And verse 8, it mentions Asher, or the ancestral peoples of the Germans. And Mr. Fleury has pointed to the Germans being the power behind this alliance. Basically, the one that's organizing everything, the one that this alliance revolves around. You tie that in with prophecies like in Daniel 11, that talk about a German-led Europe under the prophetic name the King of the North clashing with the King of the South, which Mr. Fleury has identified with Iran. And we see the Psalm 83 alliance as a group of Arab countries, Middle Eastern countries that ally against Iran in one form or another. Lebanon, or more specifically Hezbollah as it controls Lebanon, is by far one of Iran's most important proxies. But because of Psalm 83, we expect Lebanon to split from Iran and join the more pro-Western camp, if you could call it that, the European camp. And while the details on how this will be fulfilled are at this point murky, the most likely and logical expectation we can have is that Hezbollah somehow is uprooted from Lebanon. How this will play out with the coming war remains to be seen, but it certainly is an escalation of the, shall we say, normal conflict that Israel and Hezbollah have been having. And it looks like, however the dust settles, Hezbollah could very well be uprooted from Beirut. It remains to be seen again, but this is a very good opportunity, with Hezbollah being so weak, with Israel being so determined to go after Hezbollah, for other enemies of the terror group to take advantage, or for the terror group itself to even dissolve. And if you'd like to learn more about that, to give a better perspective on what's going on as the war drags on, as new twists and turns take, we have a trends article on our website called Why the Trumpet Watches: An Alliance Between Arab Nations and Europe, which can give you the general prophetic overview, which is important to keep in mind as this war with Israel and Hezbollah and other terror groups continues to develop. One other story I would like to bring up is on Friday, the same day Nasrallah was assassinated, the United States and Iraq issued a joint statement announcing that the U.S. was changing its military positions with Iraq. For America's part, they're saying it's not a withdrawal, it's just a reevaluation of where troops will be stationed, etc. But from what the text of the joint statement suggests, that at the very least is leading towards a withdrawal, and may even can potentially be interpreted as one in the future. Quoting the statement, it says that, quote, concluding the coalition's military mission in Iraq over the next 12 months and no later than the end of September 2025. And further down it states, the military mission of the coalition operating in Syria from a platform determined in the higher military commission will continue until September 2026. Syria being a satellite mission of the mission in Iraq. Now, if you read the whole statement, there is a little bit of wiggle room for the United States to keep a few troops. And according to the New York Times sources, the U.S. may keep a handful of troops in Iraqi Kurdistan. But considering everything we've seen with the Joe Biden administration regarding Afghanistan, regarding some of these other Middle Eastern ventures, it wouldn't be too hard to see this as the blueprint of a complete withdrawal from Iraq. At this point, the biggest power players in Iraq are the Popular Mobilization Units, also known as the Islamic Resistance in Iraq, which are a group of Iranian-backed Shiite militias with varying levels of government legitimacy, varying levels of being grafted into the official Iraqi military. Those are still attacking American targets in Iraq. Those are still attacking Israeli targets in solidarity with Hezbollah and Hamas. And I don't know the exact details of what went on with getting this statement prepared. From what we can tell, the U.S. was blindsided a bit by Nasrallah's assassination, but the fact that it coincided with Israel's escalation of the war in Hezbollah, that the U.S. is leaving Iraq in one form or another, effectively handing Iraq over even more so to Iranian proxies, is, I think, a very telling sign of where the U.S. stands with Iran's terror war, with Israel's war against Iran and its proxies, and what we can expect in the future. And if you would like to learn more about that, we had an article in our February edition of this year called He Was Right About Iraq.
Hello again. A far-right party won Austria's election for the first time since World War II. The Freedom Party of Austria, led by Herbert Kickl, won 28.9% of the vote, just ahead of the centre-right Conservative People's Party that won 26.3%. Now, Kickl's FPO has a pretty worrying heritage. It was founded in 1956, and its first two chairmen were former SS officers. One of their most prominent leaders in modern times, Hans Christian Strache, was arrested in Germany in 1989 for taking part in a neo-Nazi rally and photographed posing with guns alongside no neo-Nazis. Their current leader, Herbert Kickl, wants to be known as the Volkskanzler, a term that made it into the German dictionary in 1941 and defined as term for Hitler, to express the bond between the people and the Führer. So you can see what he's doing there. At the same time, he's kind of saying, well, I'm not trying to appeal to Hitler. I just want to be known as the People's Chancellor. That's a fairly generic term. It gives him a certain amount of plausible deniability, while at the same time using a term that has a long heritage of being connected to Adolf Hitler. So these two parties, the Freedom Party of Austria, this hard right party, and then the center right party, they could form a coalition together. They have done so before. But what is unique this time is that it would be the far right that is in control. They would be the senior partner. We have never seen that before. Now, the mainstream party, they're not very keen on that. They're not very keen on empowering Kickl as chancellor. At the same time, if they go in the other direction and they do a deal with a couple of left-wing parties to keep Kickl out of power, that's probably going to hurt them in the long run. People won't like the idea of them empowering the left just to avoid empowering the far right. They're probably in trouble whichever way they go. They'll lose voters whether they put the far right into power or whether they block the far right from power. Seems quite likely that Kickl's support could only grow. We might see something like the Netherlands, where Geert Wilders' party won first place, but he didn't end up as prime minister. Instead, there was kind of a non-entity that they put as prime minister, and they'll keep things going and negotiating a coalition. There was talk of that falling apart this week with Geert Wilders threatening to resign. So that's a future possibility for Austria, but not a particularly appealing one, I'm sure. We've seen so many firsts. We've seen the first far-right win German state elections. We've seen the first French government ruled with help from the far-right. Where is this trend leading? Well, it's really crucial to watch, because this trend of parties with a link to Adolf Hitler and to the fascist movement in Italy during World War II, this trend of them rising is one that we have very specifically forecast, because it comes right out of your Bible in Revelation chapter 17. And this chapter, like we come back to so often on this show, is crucial to understanding Europe. It describes this beast that has seven heads. So it's a beast in biblical symbolism is an empire. It has seven heads. It rises and falls. Revelation 17 and verse 10 says there are seven kings. Five are fallen. So that's five in the past. One is, the other is not yet come. So these are sequential. They come one after the other. Five are in the past when this prophecy is revealed. One is on the scene. One is yet to come. So where in the world do we have an empire that rises and falls, that is constantly has people trying to resurrect it again? This Revelation 17 empire is also led by a woman or a church in biblical symbolism. And again, where do you see an empire led by a church? Well, it's only in Europe, and it's only with the Holy Roman Empire. But each empire is a resurrection of what came before. And that's why it's so significant that we see these parties with ties to the Third Reich rising again. So we have Giorgio Meloni in Italy that leads a party that was founded by Mussolini supporters in 1946. There have been a couple of kind of rebrands and things like that since then, but that's essentially the roots of her party. Now we see in Austria, winning the election, a party that was founded by two SS officers. In France, this far-right or fringe-right party that's supporting the government, it was made to copy this Italian social movement that was the precursor of Giorgio Meloni's party. You know, it was made to copy the group founded by Mussolini. So all of these parties that are starting to dominate Europe all of a sudden have links going back to World War II. They've all tried to moderate themselves. They've tried to moderate their image. This has proved quite a dilemma for a lot of people. The mainstream parties will not confront migration. They've caused all kinds of economic problems. There's a lot of issues with the mainstream. And these parties with these roots have, at least in terms of appearance, moved away from those roots. How much of it is skin deep? How much of it is genuine? That's a question a lot of people are asking themselves as they go to the polls. But from our perspective, what is most important is that these do all link back to the previous resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. What we're seeing is the last resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire rising again. It is being resurrected before our eyes, and these parties are just a small part of that. They're not the only part. Politico had an article this week saying Europe has a defense commissioner. Europe has a leader when it comes to military and defense. It is the CEO of Rheinmetall. It is the CEO of Rheinmetall. So the head of this German defense company is the de facto leader of Europe's military. That's something else that we've talked about. In 1944, several top-ranking Nazis got together with German businesses, and they agreed a plan to help the Nazi Party go underground and come back again. And Rheinmetall was at the seat around that table. And now they're effectively the leader of Europe's defense. I mean, that should cause us to at least ask a few questions. And so that's another aspect of this beast power rising. These are all different aspects, different signs that this Holy Roman Empire is being resurrected before your eyes. So this is a crucial trend to watch. Our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, is absolutely essential to understanding these. We're very happy to send that to you. We also have an article from Joshua Michels on this subject that we can include in the show notes that gives you a great update on the Austrian elections. But there's a few more important stories from Europe I wanted to cover quickly. One is that France's new Prime Minister, Michel Barnier, gave his first speech to the National Assembly on October 1st, and his first priority is dealing with the debt. He said, "The sword of Damocles hanging over us is our colossal financial debt." He's put forward an incredibly radical program. Radical in terms of what he aims to achieve, of bringing in a whole lot more money through tax rises and stopping to spend a whole lot of money through tax cuts. The problem is, no one really likes it, and the French National Assembly is very, very divided. Can the nation get behind this kind of tough action that's needed to restore its finances? It really doesn't look like it, and I mean, when it comes to France, that's kind of a bit of a deja vu moment. If you think back to the French Revolution, where there was a pretty similar situation where everyone knew the debt was a problem, no one could agree on how to deal with it, and you'd have finance ministers come forwards and put forwards radical change, only to be shot down, only to have Parliament not go through with what is required. Now, the situation back then was a lot more desperate, but what happens if you have a global banking crisis? What happens if something kicks off with the US financial system? France could be in very hot water very quickly. That financial trend and this dealing with this debt and keeping economies afloat is going to play a major role in transforming Europe and in the rise of this beast power and in the strong man that leads to it coming to power. So keep watching that story. And then Germany wants to start talking to Putin again. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz wants to restart these conversations with Vladimir Putin. No other Western leader is talking to him, but Scholz wants to. He's being pushed quite heavily on this in the opinion polls, where there's a lot in Germany that do want to resume talks with Putin. It's an issue that unites left and right. The business community wants to keep doing business with Vladimir Putin. German industries have deep, deep ties to Russia. And people on the left that were kind of in favor of communism during the Cold War, they've always had this policy of dente, of peace with Russia. So watch this German-Russian relationship closely. The beast power, as it rises, is going to side with Russia against the United States. And I think behind the scenes, Germany is already siding with Russia. But for Scholz to be talking about this, maybe they're going to be doing that much more publicly soon. And one final story. Britain will surrender another vital sea gate, the British Foreign Office announced yesterday. It will hand the Chagos Islands to Mauritius. The Diego Garcia military base is a crucial military base shared with the United States. That is going to remain under British and American control under this deal. Now, Britain, we gained these islands in 1814 in the Treaty of Paris, the peace treaty at the defeat of Napoleon Bonaparte. I mean, to me, that kind of says it's ours fair and square. We did the world a massive favor in defeating Napoleon Bonaparte. I think a few islands is the least that the world can do to say thank you. I also think that after we defeated Napoleon Bonaparte, we immediately used control of the world seas to shut down the global slave trade. And that was a massive, massive force for good. And so I think it's ridiculous to complain about Britain keeping these islands. Anyway, they were governed from the British colony of Mauritius. Britain gave Mauritius its independence in 1968. We paid them the equivalent of about $40 million in today's money so that we could keep the Chagos Islands. So we gave them their independence. We paid them for the islands. That was partly to compensate moving the island's 1,500 inhabitants away to kind of create space for this crucial military base. And then in 1966, before then, we'd signed a deal with the United States allowing America to use the base. And it was critical for the war on terror, for the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. It's an unsinkable aircraft carrier just off the Middle East. It's really important. 2019, the International Court of Justice, which honestly is a bit of a joke, issued an advisory non-binding resolution that said that Britain was in the wrong to keep it. And now we've caved in. We're going to give up this crucial, crucial sea gate. The base, in theory, is going to stay there, but how many things, how many sea gates like this have we seen removed bit by bit? It wouldn't surprise me at all if the base follows. But this loss of sea gates is critical because it affects being able to project power all around the world, but even more so, it's something that just points so specifically, again, to Bible prophecy and to God revealing his prophecy through men. So Herbert W. Armstrong talked very specifically about sea gates and about Britain and America losing them. We have a whole chapter in our free book, He Was Right, called Changing of the Guard, that talks about that. And this is another very specific Bible prophecy that has been fulfilled. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back with one of our other panelists.
The stage is being set for the biggest period of turmoil in United States history. Millions of illegal immigrants are pouring over the border. America's cities are awash with crime. America's fighting two wars in different theaters around the world. And in just over a month, we're going to go into a very controversial presidential election that could even see some violent riots and protests in the aftermath. And if all this wasn't bad enough, the country is also nearing bankruptcy. The national debt is over $35 trillion. The government continues to print money and rack up trillion-dollar deficits a year. Inflation is up 20% since Joe Biden took office, and that number does not factor in housing. Housing is up another 46%, meaning that if you actually did factor housing prices in here, this could be the worst inflation in United States history. And so people are spending $8 for a dozen eggs, and budgets are being squeezed across the nation. And so in this environment, one of America's most popular financial advisors, Dave Ramsey, a man who based his financial advice on the laws from the book of Proverbs in the Bible, has reached out to both presidential candidates to talk about the way forward and what America can expect in the near future. The Harris campaign, probably predictably, has not yet responded to Ramsey's offer, but Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump jumped at the chance to sit down with Dave Ramsey and talk about some of the economic issues that everyday Americans are most concerned about. And here we'll play for you the first 3 minutes of that 30-minute interview.
So, President Trump, thanks for taking time to sit down with us.
Thank you.
Honored to be with you. Good to hang out with you. As you know, we do a show called The Ramsey Show and talk to regular folks every day calling in, most of the time with financial trouble, sometimes right. with financial victories, stuff we've taught them to do, the basic grandma's common sense stuff.
Right.
And that audience that's going to be watching this is, they're not concerned with a lot of things, but they are concerned with $8 eggs, $5 right. gas, 7% interest rates, and a house they can't afford with wages not going up as fast as house prices. Right. This inflation thing's a big deal. So in the first 90 days, the strokes that you make to change the economy when you're elected are a big deal. What's the first things you're going to do on that?
Well, in terms of inflation, you're right. And it's almost inflation over the economy, if you want to really know, because people are getting wiped out like never before. I think it's the highest inflation we've ever had. They say it's the highest in 48 years. I think it's the highest ever. There's never been any mess like this. And it's because of what they did with energy. Also, then they topped it with spending with money that trillions and trillions of dollars that they didn't need, that's being just wasted. But the first thing you have to do is get the energy down. If you get the energy down, other things are going to follow. You want to get the interest rates down, too. And interestingly, even interest rates are going to follow energy, because it's going to take that burden off the shoulders of the economy and off the shoulders of inflation itself. And we are going to drill at a level that you haven't seen since, let's say, 4 or 5 years ago. But even more so, we would have been so dominant by this point. If you remember, when you go back to the beginning of this really failed administration that we're in right now, what they did was they turned off the energy. They turned off everything that I had.
So you turned back on the Keystone. You're going to turn back on the drill, baby, drill line in the
drill.
Acceptance speech at the convention.
Sure. It says it all. You know, I'd like to use another line, but there's no line that's better. And we're going to drill, baby, drill. But the fact that they turned it off and then the energy, if you look back at the very initial period of their administration, the numbers started going through the roof, the energy numbers. Inflation was good. And then they went back to Trump, where they're trying to equal it. And it kept it bad as opposed to horrific. And it's been really bad. And the energy has been very expensive, but nothing like it could have been. So they went back to Trump type things. But we would have been now 3 to 4 times more. We would have been dominating the entire world on energy. We have more than anybody else, as you've heard me say, but as you also know.
Right.
I call it liquid gold. We have more liquid gold under our feet than anybody else. Actually, by far, we would have dominated. We would have been taking care of Europe. We would have been taking care of Asia. We would have been taking care, you know, Anwar in Alaska is the biggest find anywhere in the world. It could be as big as Saudi Arabia. And I got it. Ronald Reagan couldn't get it. Nobody could get it. I got it. It was done, ready to start. And when these people came in, they turned it off. They terminated it. Nobody could believe it.
Okay, so you heard right there Donald Trump and Dave Ramsey talking about what to expect in the economy going forward. And we heard a lot of positive things. Over the course of the interview, Donald Trump, he promised to start drilling in Alaska. He promised to open up the Keystone Pipeline. He promised to do a bunch of moves to make America an energy exporting superpower, which will reduce prices across the board. It will reduce the prices you use to fill up your tank of gasoline in your car. It'll also reduce the prices that semi-truck drivers use to fill up their semi-trucks. And since semi-trucks carry most of the goods that go to the grocery stores, all those goods will become cheaper as well. So it's really a savvy move on Trump's part to bring prices down. He also talked about in that interview reducing the tax burden on everyday Americans and putting tariffs on foreign goods to bring jobs back to America. So that will allow Americans to keep more of their paycheck, bring more high-paying jobs to America so America's salaries will go up, and reduce the cost of energy so prices will come down. Yeah, all these issues Trump talked about, while they'd be good moves for America, all address something we call non-monetary inflation. This is the type of inflation that comes from the fact that you stop drilling oil, the price for oil goes up, so the price for everything goes up. So if you can drill more oil, you'll bring the prices down by bringing energy down. That has nothing to do with monetary policy, though. The monetary inflation is the fact that the government is printing trillions of dollars and devaluing the currency. And this is one of the biggest threats to America, and something people around the world should be concerned about. because even Donald Trump isn't giving this the attention it deserves. His plan to drill for more oil is great. His plan to work for tariffs is great. His plan to reduce tax burdens are great. All these things will help American consumers. But until you run a balanced federal budget and stop printing money, the value of America's currency is going to go down. For every dollar you print, every dollar in existence is worth less. And so the fact that one-third of the dollars currently in existence were printed since the COVID pandemic. And many of them were printed while Donald Trump was still in the White House. So this is an issue where actually both Trump and Harris kind of have a blind spot, that this isn't just about energy. This is about printing trillions of dollars. Until the government stops doing this, you're going to continue having inflation problems that aren't going to affect just America, but the world. Americans are really concerned about this because they're having a hard time buying groceries. But people around the world, in Germany, in Japan, in Taiwan, should also be concerned about this, is because that if America keeps running deficits within the next 10 years, it's going to get to a point where it can no longer afford to fund its military, because interest on the federal debt will be its biggest budget item. Dave Ramsey, in this interview, he let Trump talk because he wanted Trump to present his plan to the American people. And Trump presented some good points with the money thing. But in other interviews where Dave Ramsey is actually the one giving the financial advice, he'd say that, like, whether you're a person or whether you're a nation, there's really five laws that dictate financial success. Have a written budget, live on less than you make, get out of debt, wisely invest what you save, and be generous with your wealth. And so whether you're a private individual or the United States of America, these are the five laws coming straight from the Bible that govern financial success. America, regardless of what it does with oil drilling, it has a written budget, but they don't live on less than it makes. The government spends more than it makes. It's not getting out of debt. It can't save because it's not getting out of debt. And it can't actually be generous, because all these aid packages we give to Ukraine and other nations are borrowed money. We don't actually have any wealth saved to give. And if a caller called into Dave Ramsey's show and they were breaking four of those five laws, you know they're heading towards bankruptcy. America is breaking four out of those five laws, and they're also heading towards bankruptcy. It's why Solomon said that the borrower is servant to the lender, and why Moses prophesied that in the end time descendants of Israel, if they would turn away from God's law, and one of the curses for that, as they said, the stranger would lend to them, but they would not lend to the stranger. And so if someone's lending to you, and you're not lending to them, you're in debt. And that prophecy, which is actually in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 as well, highlights the fact that, like, it's going to be this debt that's going to cause the stranger to get up above you very high. The rich rules over the poor. These foreign nations like China and that are lending to America are going to get up higher than America on the world scene because they're breaking these basic financial laws. Donald Trump's plan to reduce energy cost and maybe get salaries back up and reduce tax burdens might help you personally, but that plan isn't going to help America, the federal government, get back on a path to financial success until the government starts running balanced budgets. That's why one of the articles we can put in the show notes is by our managing editor Joel Hilliker, told, like, the national debt is America's greatest national security crisis, because it's really this national debt crisis that's going to weaken America to the point where foreign nations can eventually invade the United States and literally rule the people here. Right now, those nations don't have the power to defeat the American military, but America's debt crisis is leveling that reality very, very quickly.
So that's the biggest story in American news I wanted to bring to you this week. I really encourage you all to go listen to the full 30-minute interview between Donald Trump and Dave Ramsey. We could only give you a 3-minute preview here. There are also some other big stories in American news this week. At least 119 people were killed in Hurricane Helene that swept across the southwestern United States, just showing the type of destruction natural disasters can cause, which are another curse that God sends on nations to get their attention. It's also true that dock workers all along the East Coast have gone on strike this week, which has actually reduced America's international shipping, at least temporarily, by half. That's another thing that could increase prices at the grocery stores and make it that much more important for you to save for emergencies. And then the last thing is that while all of these crippling financial problems are afflicting America, Representative Matt Gaetz has warned that there's still at least 5 assassination teams in the United States actively hunting President Donald Trump. Type of teams that just really are trying to increase the chaos we were talking about at the beginning of this section and bring America to civil war-like conditions when you start combining this political violence with the economic troubles the nation's already suffering.
Russia has captured the Ukrainian town of Volodar. Russia had fought for 2.5 years to take this town in eastern Ukraine. There were more than 800 visually confirmed Russian military vehicles that were lost during this battle, and thousands of Russian troops were killed. But it finally paid off for President Vladimir Putin. His troops took charge of this village on Tuesday, and they raised the Russian flag there. And they actually raised the Soviet flag as well, which was interesting to see, the old flag for the Soviet Union. And that does make sense, I think, to see that flag, since Putin's main goal, despite the nonsense he says about Nazis or biolabs, his main goal is rebuilding the Soviet Union, taking the land that used to be under Russia's control during the Soviet era and violently putting it back under his control. So this Soviet flag being raised over the ruins of Volodar was an appropriate symbol of that. And this is big news inside of Russia. The capture of Volodar is being portrayed by the media there almost like something on par with the Soviet Union winning the Battle of Berlin. But it is not that in reality. This took Russia 2.5 years, as I said, and this is just a village in the middle of some farmland, and the Russians lost many thousands of soldiers to take this. More were lost even than the pre-war population of Volodar, which was 14,000. So this was not the Battle of Berlin, and it did come at an extraordinary cost for the Russians. But even so, this victory represents one of the first notable changes on the war's front lines in some time, and it gives Putin a triumph that he and his propagandists can point the Russian people to. And it'll also be of some resource value to Russia, since Volodar has one of the largest coal reserves in Ukraine. So Russia will now have considerably more coal, and Ukraine will have less. And then another important point, even though Volodar is not strategically valuable for Russia, and it was not a critical logistics hub for Ukraine, Russia's capture of it could still end up being quite significant for the war, and that's because taking Volodar could clear the way for Russia to capture Pokrovsk. And Pokrovsk is a key logistics hub for Ukraine, and losing it to Russia could be extremely detrimental to Ukraine and a tipping point for the war. So we'll have to keep our eye on this because it could end up marking a turning point in Russia's favor, and it could bolster Russia's overall momentum in the war. But whatever happens with Pokrovsk, and regardless of the war's other immediate developments, we should expect Putin to somehow come out of all this strengthened. And that's because of what Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said about his role in a coming Asian alliance. Several Bible passages talk about a massive end-time alliance of Asian nations. It's discussed in the books of Daniel and Joel and Revelation. And then there's a particularly detailed passage about this in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Verse 2 of Ezekiel 38 says this Asian alliance will be led by an individual that Young's literal translation of the Bible calls, quote, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, end quote. And Mr. Flurry has said since late 2013 that these three names refer to Russia and two of its key cities, and he has said that this passage is describing Vladimir Putin. He explains all of that in detail in his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, and the booklet shows that Putin's most momentous days lie still ahead for him. So however it happens in the near term, we should expect Putin to survive the current war and to go on to lead a colossal Asian alliance. And then a few smaller stories here. First, Japan got a new leader on Tuesday. Mr. Shigeru Ishiba is now the prime minister, and he is pushing for what he calls an Asian NATO. So this would lock the United States and Japan, as well as some nations such as India and the Philippines, into an official alliance, much like the NATO alliance for Europe and the United States and Canada. Mr. Ishiba has warned that the situation we currently see with Russia attacking Ukraine today could soon become the future for Asia, with China replacing Russia and with Taiwan playing the role of Ukraine, the invaded nation. So to prevent that is a big part of the reason why Prime Minister Ishiba wants an Asian NATO. And it's very notable that he thinks this Asian NATO needs nuclear weapons. In the past, he has advocated for Japan to maintain the ability to build nuclear weapons. And with his proposals about a nuclear-armed Asian NATO, it's clear that he's calling for more than just the United States to have nuclear weapons. So it's still very much the early days for Mr. Ishiba's leadership, but from what we've seen so far, it looks like he could play a notable role in advancing the trend of Japan's militarization. Next up is another story of Chinese belligerence and violence in the South China Sea. This time it was a Vietnamese vessel that the Chinese bullied. This was on Wednesday, and the vessel is a Vietnamese fishing boat. It was near the Paracel Islands, which are claimed by both China and Vietnam. And Vietnam state media reported that around 40 people from two Chinese boats actually beat the Vietnamese fishermen with pipes and injured 10 of them, some apparently quite seriously. Vietnam says three of these fishermen had bones broken from this attack. So this week it's Vietnam. Next week it might be the Philippines again, or Indonesia, or Bhutan, or another nation. But in any case, China's belligerence seems to be soaring to new heights as the Chinese Communist Party keeps on frantically trying to take over the entire South China Sea. Then one final story here about how your Chinese electric car might be spying on you. This report was published in the Telegraph on Monday, and it talks about how owning a Chinese-made electric car could give the Chinese Communist Party access to spy on you and worse. There is evidence that Chinese hackers have already accessed an American-made electric car, a Tesla Model S, and the Chinese actually tampered with its brakes. So it's really alarming to think about the implications of this kind of thing, especially with a car that China built and had the chance to create secret access points in that they could later come back and exploit. And I think that after the attack we saw by Israel, blowing up Hezbollah's pagers and walkie-talkies and killing and injuring thousands of terrorists with that, after that attack, it has become much more clear just how dangerous technological reliance can be. And as cars become more technologically advanced, with critical functions that are controlled by centralized computers, this new report says that they are becoming more vulnerable to sabotage by enemies.